Welcome to the session on preferred slicing. It will be chaired by Wolfgang here and me. And most of us are probably reluctant to the idea of abandoning something as sacred as GR's refoliation invariants. But there are reasons why one might consider this possibility. That's been already observed here, in particular by cosmologists, that there is a preferred frame in our universe because it's a particular solution of GR, so it doesn't have to have all of the symmetries of the theory. And there are other solutions, for example, the fact that the problem of many finger time that is present in GR can be solved by assuming that the preferred slicing is fundamental. Quantum mechanics might work better in such a situation. So without further hesitation, I want to introduce you to Chopin Tzu, if I pronounce it correctly. He will be our first provocateur, and he will try to defend the idea that we can use a preferred global slicing, and in particular, he wants to use an intrinsic notion of time, so something that has to do with the intrinsic geometry of the three-dimensional slices. So welcome.
Okay, so before I start, let me record my gratitude and debt to Lee, who was my mentor and still is my mentor after so many years. So, from the other side of the world, when you reach the grand old age of 60, grand old age is, 60 is considered grand old age in ancient China, we say, "祝你, 福如东海, 寿比南山, which translates into, "May your fortune be comparable to the eastern seas and your longevity be comparable to the southern mountains." That's the literal translation, and it sounds exaggerated and insincere, but you see, the literal translation did not translate the spirit. For the correct translation is, "I wish you the best and the best of the very best. For what can top having a fortune greater than the eastern seas?" Okay. So now, actually, that saying, you can tell by that saying that he has a preferred frame, because because the seas are to the east and the mountains to the south. It doesn't work, you know, if you are in a country where the sea is all flat and to the south. All right, so the title, I'm trying to make a case for fundamental global intrinsic time. Now, I note down some of the things that our organizers and hosts said, and in response to Marina's coaxing during the banquet, I do agree with our organizers and hosts, particularly these things here, talking about time without thinking about the universe is hopeless. And Roberto has a third approach, that our universe is one of a kind. Explanation of time in cosmology should not be practiced as a scale-up version of local physics. It's also important how this squares up with general relativity, and causation is fundamental to nature. And Marina also, we need a theory of the whole universe. And Lee, the universe allows no and needs no external clock. So in that spirit, let's take the whole universe, you know, let's go the whole hog, and take the ever-expanding universe as the ultimate clock. So I'm going to use the logarithm of the volume of the universe, where psi is nothing but the wave function of the whole universe, and the spatial volume of the universe V. Now, to a cosmologist, or to some, you know, this sounds like the type of question I want to know in quantum gravity. I don't care if you can answer. If I can answer this question, I practically already answered everything. But really, there is a conflict or tension with four covariance in this simple scheme. This common sense scheme has a conflict and tension with four covariance, because this cannot be four covariant. This is gauge dependent. It's a preferred slice. Okay. However, quantum gravity carries a message, one in which Einstein's four covariant classical general relativity hides. And that message is, well, before I go to that message, there's an essential conflict between the existence of fundamental time and four covariance of Einstein's theory. Now, those against yesterday were 16 votes for fundamental time, against fundamental time, and they have all embraced four covariance. Maybe some of them have, some of them not. Those who embrace four covariance are probably quite consistent in the approach that they took. But there were a majority, 26 votes of fundamental time believers, they will be tacked on the label fundamentalist by the other camp, have yet have not yet all declared themselves to be skeptics of full covariance and heretics. So I'm trying to be provocative here. So quantum gravity carries a message, and that message has the messenger is none other than John Wheeler. And the message was loud and clear. There is no such thing called full geometry. Okay, because in quantum geometrics, for no properly amplitude can propagate through superspace as an indefinitely sharp package. There's a non-commutation between pi and the tree metric. And therefore, if you know the four metric, you can calculate it precisely. But that's not allowed. So there's no four. Four manifold is not a valid concept in quantum gravity. In fact, Wheeler stressed you have three dimensions, not four, and it's three geometry and not four geometry. So if we can have only three geometry and not four, and we have only three dimensions and four dimensions, space-time is really a classical concept of limited applicability, why do we want to impose four covariance with a symmetry of four-dimensional space-time? At least entertain the thought that this, if it cannot be, or just need not be fundamental to quantum gravity. And yet, there is that damn equation, and the person who cursed his own equation suggested that time should be determined intrinsically. Intrinsically means from the tree metric itself rather than extrinsic, like extrinsic curvature. So DeWitt suggested intrinsic definition of time. And probably he got it by looking at the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. There's a minus sign. And the intrinsic variable, time variable, he chose was the determinant of the tree metric, the one called the power. But this intrinsic time variable is multi-fingered. And I'll try to discuss this a little bit. It's problematic for the time ordering of quantum evolution. It's a tensor density. It's gauge dependent. So if you use this intrinsic time, it's still not the ordering or the that you get will still not be general covariant, will still not obey the symmetries of the theory. Okay. Now, log volume is, as this intrinsic time, is spatial diffeomorphism invariant, but it's not full covariant. Okay. But it's global. So, but we know that there are technical difficulties with full covariance. It's non-renormalizable. So one of the suggestions was to give up four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance in favor of three-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance for power counting renormalizability. Because when you have four covariance, when you try to tweak the theory for better convergence with higher spatial derivatives, you also introduce higher time derivatives. That makes the theory not unitary. So the strategy is to improve by convergence by adding spatial derivatives and not higher time derivatives. Of course, this breaks core covariance. Now, let me skip this because I may not have time to say this. So what I'm trying to be provocative here is that we should try a paradigm shift from four covariance to three-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance. We have a Hamiltonian evolving time, generating time translation through T, which is the volume of the universe, logarithm of the volume of the universe, and we have a physical Hamiltonian, which will try to reproduce as fast as possible Einstein's physics of general relativity, and we only require three covariance. And we have a wave function obeying three-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance. And we give up that damn equation, the Hamiltonian constraint. And so we will be consistent. There's nothing. Now our time will then obey all the symmetries of the theory. Okay? And there'll be no inconsistency in the scheme. The problem is, how does it square with general relativity? Will this Hamiltonian that you introduce be able to reproduce the physics of general relativity? And just for concreteness, the Hamiltonian which you should use to reproduce the physics of general relativity as best as possible looks like this. Now, I will not have time to discuss this, but we can discuss it later if you want and look how it does the job. So the potential is Einstein's theory. It will reduce Einstein's theory if you have this, okay, the scalar potential and the Kolmogorov constant. But you can add further terms because you only have three covariance. Okay, so let's skip all these technical details. Now, the point is, then we have a fundamental time, which is the logarithm of the volume of the universe. And this theory is exact. It's not a mini superspace model. That time is exact, and it's three covariant. And barring conclusive evidence to the contrary, observationally, our universe has always increased in size and time. So perhaps it's a signal that the fundamentalists got it right. okay? That there was really no four Courants. Now, in Friedman, Robertson, Walker models, the time interval between then and now, it tells you the volume, and that can be measured by the redshift. So there's no problem converting time from the volume of the universe to redshift. And so it really is a measure of time if you say, I look at it and sketch a redshift. That's the mini superspace model. But in the full theory, the volume of the universe will play the role of time itself. Okay, so what's the upshot of this? Now, the upshot of having one fundamental time, it's the fundamentalist one, is that when you go to classical mechanics through Hamilton-Jacobi equation, through Hamilton's equation, it's the same T. I think this answers a question which George was trying to emphasize this morning. It's the same T. So that fundamental time is the same. Now, the other thing is that in all of physics, there's nothing that prevents you from having an explicitly time-dependent Hamiltonian in the Hamilton-Jacobi, in the theory. Okay. So what's the upshot of the paradigm shift? The upshot is that now, because we give up four covariants, we have a gauge invariant or three-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance, time evolution, and time ordering. This allows the tweaking modification of potential, and I'll explain the rest later. So first, the time ordering. One of the things that fundamentalists probably find disturbing about having the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and multi-fingered time is that this is already said by Wheeler many years ago, that the time ordering of events is the notion devoid of all meaning. And there's no way you can fit all this into a single four geometry. And one has to forego the view that every event, past, present, and future occupies this preordained position in a grand catalog called space-time. And there's no space, there's no time, and there's no before, there's no after. The question of what happens next is without meaning. Okay, that's a real provocation to the fundamentalists. Okay, so then the question is, if we have general covariance, is there a temporal ordering which is invariant under all the symmetries of the theory? If you have multi-fingered time, does it lift the path dependence, non-equilibrity? The path versus time ordering is different. Time is one-dimensional. You can only go forward, backward, and this ordering is so-called linear ordering, whereas when you have multi-fingered time, it's not. So the question I want to ask the other camp is, what really is the meaning of causality when you have that Wheeler-DeWitt equation? Okay, this is the part which I am very confused about. And this is the question I wish to ask. What kind of causality do you have? It's not the usual type. The usual type of having a fundamental time is that you have this. And the solution of this equation is the time-ordered exponential of the Hamiltonian, and this is the evolution operator. And it's all ordered in the one-dimensional time. This ordering has no ambiguity because it's only one-dimensional. Okay, this is linear time ordering. And so we place, as Roberto said so elegantly, placing the whole cosmic history in a single line. And that's the solution in the time ordering. And the wave function of the universe is our shared history, present, and future. Now, in usual quantum field theory, let's say Minkowski space-time, it is the requirement of having to be able to time order your time development that you require the commutation of the Hamiltonian outside the light cone. And so that's a very important causality, and that's how it was achieved. So now, the next part is that, well, this argument was brought up. This argument was brought up earlier on in a few days ago. So that I just want to say that the figure is, if you take a solar mass and collapse into a black hole, you get 10 to the 21 baryons, entropy of 10 to the 21 per baryon. If it's 10 to the 80, you get 10 to the 100. And one, if there are more, if you get bigger black hole collapse and collisions and so on, you get higher numbers, 10 to the 123. But the number is e to the 10 to the 123 and not 10 to the 123 in terms of number of states. So why didn't the universe start off with a black hole instead of a very smooth Big Bang? So now, 10 to the 120 was the number associated with the cosmological constant problem. In the game of Go, you have 19 times 19 intersections. So 19 times 19 factorial, if you consider all moves legal, but they are not. Some of them are not legal. Anyway, the upper bound is something like 10 to the 700. But 10 to the 10th or e to the 10 to the 123, is so-called unlikeliness of our extraordinary special Big Bang. So if this was called a crisis, then the failure to explain this would be catastrophe? Okay, so the failure of Einstein's theory to naturally account for this extraordinary special initial condition is another consideration. So the point is, can a three-dimensional diffeomorphism invariant theory fare better? And somewhat surprisingly, because we have only three-dimensional diffeomorphism invariants, we can try to add further terms. And one of the terms that you can add is the Yorck conformal tensor. That term is scale invariant. Now, we are using the volume of the universe as time. So if you look at Hamiltonian, the various terms have various dependence on the determinant of the metric. But this Yorck tensor is independent of it. So at very small volumes, these are all suppressed. And the largest volumes, you have dominance by the cosmological constant term. But at very, very small volumes, in the very early universe, only the Yorck term kicks in. So you are having a time-dependent Hamiltonian because this was your time. But then this time appeared naturally due to the kind of curvature tensor that we add in, which is a function of tree metric and the unimodular part. And so you get Cauton-Yorck dominance at early times. Now, Cauton-Yorck dominance at early times means, here as I said, you get Cauton-Yorck dominance and late times you get cosmological constant volume. So the potential in the Hamiltonian is dominated by Cauton-Yorck tensor density at early cosmological and at late times by the cosmological constant. So that means the lowest energy configuration, if you have something like this Hamiltonian has something like g pi pi, this eccentric curvature, at early times it's just a Cauton-Yorck tensor square. So the lowest energy state corresponds to having zero Cauton-Yorck tensor density and zero momentric, which means zero eccentric curvature and conformally three-dimensional conformally flat. And for spatially compact problems, it's just S square, S3. And so you naturally obey the Robertson-Walker configuration. Okay. And this is compatible with Fenrel's initial configuration, Fenrel's Weyl curvature hypothesis. Now, if you get the low entropy, then the Hamiltonian also explicitly depends on time, and so therefore it's not time reversal variable. You already get this asymmetry. It's not invariant under t equals to minus t or v equals to 1 over v. But the unitarity of the theory will be preserved as long as the Hamiltonian submission, all v is time dependent. So our universe is, you get all this asymmetry that you want. Okay, so that's the upshot. So a specific scheme will maybe use this. And you can see that at various times, various terms kicks in because of the dependence on the determinant of the metric, which is time. So it's effectively like saying, you have a theory of time dependence, which means that you can have really different laws at different times without really having that. It's just to have a time-dependent Hamiltonian. But time dependence was not put in ad hoc, but it came from this geometrical considerations and using the volume of the universe as time. Okay, so probably I'll stop here. Is that, well, probably one more sentence. Einstein's GR will dominate at low curvatures because that's the Einstein GR term. And then the rest are higher curvature, and they are also curvature square terms. And these non-GR terms are absent in the really homogeneous Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric with constant curvature. So you don't see them, but any inhomogeneity, they will show up. And also in the plane Lebesgue Gaussian solutions of black holes, where you have constant curvature slicings. And the Chern-Simon, then the Cauton-Yorck preponderance at early universe, and Einstein derivates a low curvature long wavelengths in the theory in which four-dimension symmetry is not a fundamental property of the physical world. Okay, so I think I'll stop
here. Thank you. Yes. So let's thank Fu-Bin. Questions regarding the talk in particular? I see no hands raised. Yes.
Two or comment slash question. One is not too important, but you talked about the time order product as it's used in quantum field theory.
Yes.
It sounded like you implied that required a linear time, but then you immediately showed us that it doesn't require a linear time if you have the spatial commutator vanishing. So Would you agree with that? I mean, the time-ordered product makes sense without any linear.
But that time ordering
without any linear time in that context.
Yes. But that time ordering product was compatible with the isometry of the theory. That's Lorentz invariant. So
yes.
And so is this. If you have absence four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariants, then this too will give rise to a gauge invariant, three-dimensional diffeomorphism invariant ordering.
No, I'm not worried about that.
My question is, for the totally covariant case, do you get an ordering or some ordering which is completely compatible with four-dimensional diffeomorphism symmetry?
I think your question is, do you get it in quantum gravity? In a curved space, there's certainly such a thing as quantum field theory in curved space-time,
yes,
which has a time-ordered product that is compatible with the full four-dimensional nature of,
but in
of
quantum
the space-time.
In quantum gravity.
In quantum gravity, we don't have a background space-time, so it wouldn't actually make sense to talk about. You wish to have a background time.
No.
And then you have to have a time ordering, time-ordered product compatible with that background.
Yes.
Let's call it background, your T or V, but.
Yes. And
so,
and this T that I have is the logarithm of the volume of the universe. That's not a background.
Yeah, let's not call it a background, but then you would have, well, this is another comment. You would have no ability for the universe to recontract. It would be built into your.
So,
but there are solutions, plenty of solutions of the Einstein equation in which the cosmos recontracts.
Yeah, I agree.
You'd have to say that they're somehow ruled out physically, I think.
So this will be falsifiable if there are evidence that in the early universe, our universe have contracted and re-expanded and so on. For instance, the periodic models. Okay, so if the evidence for that is very strong, then it's ruled out. And also, I think, also, these extra terms which you add in, let's say I take one of those. Those extra departures from Einstein's theory, if they are present, you can detect them. If they are not, then they're wrong. So this theory is falsifiable.
I'm not saying it's not a testable.
Yeah.
And one last thing. I didn't understand your argument from entropy because you have apparently a Hamiltonian theory with unitary evolution.
Yes.
So we could make the same argument that you quoted from Roger, that we could talk about if you evolve backward the situation that now has these black holes in a much higher entropy, either something will break down or you will go back to an early state in which is much higher entropy. So how are you planning?
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
I understand. But what I'm saying is that the extra terms makes it such that at very small volumes, the York tensor dominates, the York-Cotton-York tensor dominates.
Yes.
Yes. And so the lowest energy configuration is one in which it vanishes.
But why should it be? Oh, so you have a new principle, it should be in the lowest energy configuration.
No, but I'm saying that's, well, yes, and I'm saying that that's.
I mean, that's right. I just want to understand.
With that condition, you can explain the 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 123. Whereas in Einstein's theory, you will have to come up with some. You see, what I'm trying to say is that if you break this, you can have easier explanations than having to get a very fine-tuned explanation. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long discussion, but I think that in practice you just have a different way of posing an initial condition. But if you ask physically, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, maybe that's a very nice way of condensing the assumption that's being made. But the physical reason why we see low energy in systems is precisely because of the second law of thermodynamics and the increase of entropy. The reason you see low energy for an isolated system is that by going down into it, you know, the bottom of its potential, Carlos, like, you go back to the bottom of the potential well, you some you release radiation or some particles or something like that, and they explore a big phase space. So low energy is actually associated with high entropy when it, you know, if it's evolved for the in the situations that we're familiar with. The physical origin, if there is a ground state, it's sought out only because some other part of the universe is not in the ground state, and in such a way that the local ground state is realized, but at the cost, or because it has the effect of enhancing the global entropy. But you want a low entropy. So I'm just worried that there's some sort of circularity, physical point of view of circularity. Yes.
And
that you should start with low energy.
I'm trying to say that at very early times, when the universe is very small, the one that corresponds to the Robertson-Walker configuration has very low energy.
Yeah.
Yes. So that picks it out. Okay. Now, whether or not we should have very high energies or very low energies at the beginning, and there's another motivation, is that that also makes the lowest energy makes the extrinsic curvature zero, then that junction condition allows you to continue to Euclidean. Okay, so if we started from a Euclidean continuation, that would be the configuration continue over, and then you get this extra York tensor vanishing and gives you a S3 kind of manifold.
But is that sort of quantum tunneling?
Yes, yeah.
It is an initial condition.
Yeah. So that's the another motivation for it.
Yes. So I like your motivations from Wheeler and so on. And one point that I would just add, I don't think there's a dichotomy between fundamental and emergent time. I think you could have this time, but yet beings within this reconstructed universe could have a feeling of emergent duration, just from how things change within that construction, within that space-time, or whatever you want to call it. So just a technical point that I don't quite understand is that I thought you were eliminating the local scale to solve the scalar constraint. But that's not what you're doing, because you still have a local square root there.
So the Hamiltonian is a function of the traceless variables.
Yeah.
The unimodular part and also determinant part, which is Q, which is time. So it's a time-dependent Hamiltonian. Okay? What is not there is pi, which is not the Hamiltonian.
Do you use only the incompressible diffeomorphisms? Sorry, maybe this is too technical. We can discuss it later.
Yeah.
But I mean, maybe I can intervene here. The question here is, what about conformal invariants? Does the Hamiltonian commute with a...
Only diffeomorphism invariants.
Only diffeomorphism.
Oh, but full diffeomorphism or incompressible diffeomorphisms?
Three-dimensional, generated by Hamiltonian diffeomorphism constraint.
But those change the determinant of the metric.
Yes. Yes.
But I thought you were the
Hamiltonian is a tensor density of weight 1, and integrated over the tree space in Hamiltonian density.
It is.
But the
related question is how many, there's Sean, but maybe, how many local degrees of freedom do you have?
Two.
I'm not sure about that.
Yes.
You're constraining your configuration space only with three local constraints.
Yes, but pi has been eliminated, and Q is now time. So I have Q bar and pi bar. Q is a unimodular, and pi bar is a traceless part, subject to three-dimensional diffeomorphism constraint, which are three.
Yes, so you have conformal invariants then. The degrees of freedom are three.
No, but the Hamiltonian, Hamiltonian doesn't commute.
Okay, but it's a second class system. I don't see how you can get two local degrees of freedom, but maybe we should discuss about that later. There was a question by Sean.
Okay. Yeah, I gotta ask a question. No. I was just wondering if you replaced. So, it's an interesting theory. But if you instead of putting log of 3 volume, I thought you were gonna put log of 4 volume, because that thing is diffeomorphism invariant.
You mean four-dimensional diffeomorphism variance?
Yes.
Yes.
So then it's not necessarily, it's absolutely necessary that you have to select a preferred slicing, right? If your time is a...
My time is the logarithm of the three-dimensional volume of the universe.
Okay.
From the point of view of four covariant theory, that we prefer slicing. But from the point of view of a three-dimensional diffeomorphism invariant theory, that's not preferred slicing. So that...
Okay, any other questions, comments?
No, I only wanted to remember when Lee was always calling me saying that Chopin is working for him.
Yes. Well, if we have time, I can explain that. See, when we started.
And thank you for the translation, right. The book also.
Our chairman asked me how to pronounce this. I say the pronunciation guy is here.
See, it was not very helpful.
So, now, it turns out that this depends on how you say it in different dialects. And in one of the dialects really is Chopin, and in another dialect is Chopin. So I take all pronunciations.
I see.
There's a duality here.
So Lee was right after all.
Yes.
Something else? Some wrist ends, fingers. Okay, then let's thank Chopin again.
Where's the clicker?
And now, this is it. I leave it to Wolfgang to introduce Sean.
So it's also a great pleasure to be here and speak in this conference. So I will not speak, but rather just introduce Sean Grip, who is doing shape dynamics and working at Radboud University in Nijmegen, and he will tell us about preferred slicing, and I'm sure we will have some heated discussions throughout this.
I hope so. So when I was asked to give a talk in defense, or a provocative talk to engage some kind of discussion on preferred slicing, and when I saw the audience, I kind of felt a little bit like this guy in this picture, that I'd be slightly poking the bear. So I'm Canadian, and I thought that we always have the hockey stick at perimeter. So I felt just to feel a little bit more comfortable, but also to defend myself if things get too hairy, that I can use the stick. On the other hand, so first I'd also like to thank the organizers. This is a really great opportunity for me, and I'm really happy to be speaking to all these really interesting, smart people, and I hope that we can get some good discussion going. But I also have the honor of trying to make sure that there's still some energy, so I'll try to, I'm worried this bear has gone into hibernation, so I'm gonna try to up the energy in the room if I can. Also, I should say that I'm reasonably agnostic on this topic, actually, despite my publication record. But what I'll try to do is present the different sides of the argument and hopefully highlight points for discussion or possible contention that I will perhaps try to defend or not. Let's see. Okay. So anyway, before I get started, I just wanted to motivate the problem. So the reason why you might want to think about considering a preferred slicing in the first place. So classical general relativity is invariant under active space-time diffeomorphisms. The word active is a story that I don't really have time to tell. But this might make you want to try to find a quantum representation of the same symmetry group. So you might want to look for a representation of your Hilbert space, which is a representation of the diffeomorphism algebra. And this turns out to be an extremely difficult problem to solve. So Lee pointed this out earlier in the conference, just how hard it is to do this in the canonical theory, and which is, he suggested that might have been why people abandoned the canonical theory to look for a spin foams. But it does show up in many different ways. And I would say that this is probably, I worked hard to word this in a non-controversial way, but I think most people would agree that in over 50 years of lots of really smart people working on this problem, there is no general consensus about a resolution to it. Okay, and so given that we've had such a difficult problem open for so long, one might think that it's time to think about different solutions. Okay, and I'm not sure that the particular solution I might try to suggest is even radical enough, and that's sort of why I'm agnostic. But at least it's a start in some direction. Okay, so before I get started, I want to point out what are the issues and what are not the issues. So separate the real problems from the red herrings. Okay, so it didn't take long for people to realize after Einstein wrote down general relativity that actually general covariance on its own doesn't have any physical content. Okay, and just as an example, you can imagine formulating Maxwell electrodynamics in a generally covariant way just by specifying Minkowski space through the vanishing of the curvature tensor. You need some topological restriction here. And then taking the volume element, multiplying it by square root of g, and then promoting partial derivatives to covariant derivatives. And then I can write this in any coordinate system that I want, and I can make predictions about the same physics. So everybody here knows this, but it's an interesting reminder to keep this in our head. And why is, why is it that you can do this? Why is there no physical content in general covariance? And the reason is because you're talking about a symmetry. You're talking about a symmetry is something that's not there, not something that is there. And I think that in our language, we often forget that. So these are arbitrary labels that we use as stand-ins for real things. And I really like the way that George Ellis described it. He said, a simultaneity surface is an imaginary thing. I mean, that's a paraphrase, but because I couldn't remember the real quote. But it was something like that. And I completely agree, and I think we all do, that the labels are about inferences that we make about the location of real events based on some assumptions or conventions. Okay, so we can make different assumptions and conventions, make different inferences, but that doesn't change the fact that those events happened. So I read this a lot in the literature. People talk about violating the spirit of general covariance. And I have no idea what that means. And my claim here is that it's just a red herring. That's why they put the Holy Spirit anyway. something I want to flag, because I don't want to conflate issues here. So what's the real issue? I mean, what was Einstein's beautiful insight really? And there might be some disagreement already about this, but this is what I think is slightly uncontroversial, is that what do we really need? We need to define inertial structure. So basically, we need to know what a force is. What is an acceleration? Okay, and in order to do that, we don't want some choice of inertial structure to be favored by the formalism. So that's my reading of the principle of relativity. And general relativity does that. And the way that it does that is it just allows the metric to be freely varied. So the inertial structure is, what I mean by inertial structure is I mean the specifying the time-like geodesics. Because it's the geodesic observers who can locally use their Fermi normal coordinates to build local rod and clock systems that are at rest, okay, with respect to the geometry. And so the metric determines that, but the metric is not determined a priori. It's a result of fixing boundary conditions and doing a variation over various matter fields, okay? So because this thing is, because these inertial observers are a result of some variational principle, there's no particular inertial structure which is specified a priori. And then you have, so your formalism is in some sense indifferent to this background. And I think that's really the key principle. And so what's the observation now is that general covariance plays only a secondary role here. Okay, if you want to write down the theory in terms of a metric in some coordinate system which you integrate, then you need to introduce coordinates. But those things are not physical. The geodesics of the metric are something intrinsically geometric. They have nothing to do with the coordinates that you write down. So they do play a role in somehow writing down the theory, but they play a role in such a way that you want to get rid of them at the end. So with that said, what would be the argument for preferred slicing? Well, fixing a set of coordinates doesn't fix or privilege a particular frame. And I noticed that those words were used sometimes in this conference, and it's just not true. If I do physics in a particular coordinate system, it does not privilege necessarily a particular frame. And what's the next step? Well, when you're quantizing a gauge theory, you need to gauge fix at some point. You don't have a choice. It doesn't matter what formulation you're using. At some point, you have to do some kind of gauge fixing. And some gauge fixings are better than others. Okay? So that's the mildest way you can put an argument towards having a preferred slicing, just a convenient set of coordinates to do the quantization. But people will still say you lose something by doing this. And so the next couple slides will be about the cost of doing such a thing. Okay? And I think this is where people start to object about the use of a preferred slicing. So there are some issues. One of the issues is that you might say that finding the Jacobian for the gauge fixing that you're choosing could be just as hard or insurmountable as finding the anomaly-free representation of the diffeomorphism group anyway, right? So it could just be the same problem in a different language, and you have to work just as hard to solve it. And I'm going to...
Jacobian in the
Fedea
Popov sense?
Yeah, in the Fedea Popov sense. I'm going to quote Sean here and just regard this as a homework problem. Okay, I'm going to use that. Is he here? Yeah, there he is.
So,
yeah, well, neither am I. Now what you might worry about here, though, is that if you can't calculate this thing, it's a field theory, so you have to do some kind of regularization. What you might worry about is that the quantization process itself will, if you do it in a particular reference frame, the quantization might privilege some inertial structure. And then you have really selected a preferred frame. And so here I'm gonna poke the bear. I'm gonna flag this as a topic for discussion because I think I heard Lee say this at some point. Maybe this is something that we have to live with. Another way of putting it is maybe this is telling us something deep about quantum gravity, that if we can't solve this problem, then maybe we should. Is that the bear? Oh, maybe we'll. So good. Let's come to get back to this point. So I flagged it as a topic to discuss. Maybe this is something telling us deep about the nature of time, okay? Or not. I don't know. But we should talk about that. The other issue, and I worded this very carefully, is that this to me is the bigger problem, right? That if you work in a set of coordinates, you run into the problem where the coordinates break down. So I call this a Grebov horizon, because gauge fixings typically do this, right? They don't cover, they have some region of validity where they fail. And coordinates are a good example.
The Grebov problem,
No, this is not the Grebov problem, Grebov horizon. So Grebov horizon is where the Jacobian of the transformation is zero. And you run into degeneracy. So you actually reach. Yeah. Oh, yeah, but no. If you want to do this formally, right?
Okay, my friends, now it's time for us to start.
You want to pick some slicing. Okay. One way to do
that. Hi, my name is Aggie. My latest hobby is.
There's a gauge fixing condition, which will be on, yeah. Yes. Yeah, yes. So actually, in this case, a Grebov horizon is kind of maps to a real horizon. So a coordinate, like a horizon due to a coordinate, yeah. But what we all agree is that maybe it was a poor choice of wording, but we all agree that there are coordinates patches that don't cover entire spacetimes. And this is a real problem if you want to quantize in a particular slicing, I think. Perhaps it's the problem. The reason why I called it a Grebov horizon is because I said that these kinds of things are not just unique to gravity. In Yang-Mills, these kinds of problems are unavoidable. People have learned to live with them. So maybe there are ways to also live with them in gravity.
Okay? Sean?
There's an urgent, okay.
I take Flavio's point as well. But my question is, here, finding the Jacobian shouldn't be very difficult. Do you think you might mean find a gauge or a slicing that is, or a regularization that is invariant with respect to your gauge symmetry or something like that? Because the Jacobian is the determinant of a differential operator, usually. So anyways, I mean.
No, but you have to, look, if in path integral language, if you're talking about functional RG, what I'm saying is that you still have to sort out what all your ghosts are. Right? That's an unsolved problem in the asymptotic safety formula program, right? People don't have control over all the ghosts that they use to perform their gauge fixings. And that's a really difficult problem, okay? So that's just the path integral manifestation of I think, what's happening in the canonical theory.
Okay.
All right. I don't know if that's cutting into my, I don't know how much time I have left. But anyway, so, okay, so this is, there could be many ways out of this problem, all right? And I'm going to suggest two, which I've written papers about, because then I might be able to defend myself better if I write this on the slide, okay? But there may be other ways. I'm not suggesting this is an exhaustive list of things. But one option is to change your fundamental ontology. Okay, so I don't mean to make a radical change to the theory. I mean to move to something which is mathematically equivalent, but has a different metaphysical picture underlying it. I think I must have blew through something. I blew through this point. So the issue is that on spacetime you have this principle of maximum extendability. The real issue is, if you have a coordinate patch and you have a time-like observer, and the time-like observer goes outside of that coordinate patch, what happens to that time-like observer, right? That's the problem. That's the paradox. If you have some slicing, somebody leaves it, you lose the ability to have a holistic view of the world. So the ability to be able to transform to different slicings allows you to capture, build a maximal extension of your space-time and really get a global picture of what's going on, okay? That's what I think is the big problem here. And what you can do to fix that is if you change your ontology, and then you can substitute this principle of maximum extension. You don't have a space-time anymore, and you replace it with something like maximal extension of your new ontology. So in shape dynamics, that is going to be the new phase space that you have. So let me be more concrete. What we do in shape dynamics is we have a new symmetry principle, which we use to fix the coordinates. So we fix the coordinates by requiring, let me state it this way. There exists a choice of simultaneity where the local degrees of freedom are invariant under spatial scale transformations, local spatial scale or conformal vial transformations. Okay, so that allows us to say, maybe this is a nice set of coordinates because it allows us to define a new ontology, which is one not of space-time, but of evolving conformal geometries. So we say, now what's real about our world is that we have evolving conformal geometries. And then instead of requiring maximal extension on space-time, we just require that our solutions on phase space are maximally extendable. Okay? So we can still have a complete view of the world. It's just a different world than the one we had before. Okay, I don't know how, hopefully that was clear. And that's what I was gonna say. So once you have that in the that classical theory written down, then you try to quantize that. Yeah?
By the time we're
Yeah, so certainly I'd be happy to produce things that may not even have, well, what I want to be able to do is reproduce spacetimes, which are solutions to the Einstein equations for some field content locally. But globally, I might have to patch together different solutions that look like that. So these things might be degenerate as spacetimes, but still well-defined as curves on conformal superspace. Okay. So typically, there might be some weird junction condition that in the spacetime picture. Yeah. All right. It's a possible way out. I'm not saying it's the only one, and I'm not, well, I advocate it in the sense that I've written quite a few papers on it, but another option, which I'm just going to end quickly with, is, I mean, it's possible, and there's a tradition for doing so in the foundations of quantum mechanics, to think about the wave function, or probabilities at least, as a lack of knowledge of the fundamental degrees of freedom. So you have some epistemic restriction on whatever, some hidden variable theory, which is quantum gravity. And then you think about the wave function as the evolution of the wave function as some updating about the knowledge of that in like unknown theory or unknown degrees of freedom. So, but if you want to think about the universe in this way, then you don't care about having a holistic picture of the world, because it's your interpretation of quantum mechanics is primarily epistemic. So it relies on what a particular observer can know. And if a particle, a time-like particle, goes outside of the causal horizon of some observer, then it really does disappear. Okay? So it's just saying that perhaps if you want to think epistemically about the wave function, then you don't really have to deal with this problem. And we just had a paper on this. So trying to flesh this out in more detail. So I'm going to end there. Okay.
For questions, particularly on this talk, and then the idea is to go on with a panel discussion with both of our speakers. So I would now like to ask for questions particularly addressed to Sean.
Yeah, it's the same thing I asked you just before.
Yeah.
So maybe can we interpret this as saying, if we want to take the four-dimensional point of view, that what you're doing is asking us to accept certain kinds of singularities in space-time.
Yes.
And if that's true, then I just want to point out there's another reason that one might want to accept certain kinds of singularities, which is change of topology. Although I think change of topology might be a little harder. I'm not sure that it can be incorporated in this framework. But nevertheless, if you think of that from a four-dimensional point of view, then you do want to accept, for example, certain points, space-time points, at which the metric degenerates to accommodate the kind of cobordism that would mediate the change of topology. So maybe there's another formula. Do you think there might be another formulation of this that's saying, well, it just is GR, but with a certain relaxation of a global Lorentzian signature everywhere, you know, and smooth C infinity or whatever. I mean, you want to relax those conditions certain extent.
I mean, I would say you can do that. And in fact, I know of a way to do it, which was in the original paper by Einstein and Rosen, on the Einstein-Rosen bridge. They suggested just dividing the Einstein equations, or multiplying by the right power of square root of g to cancel all of these coordinate divergences. And Einstein, I mean, I guess it's his field equations, right? He can do what he wants. I thought that was the kind of thing that nobody would ever think to do now. But he just said, well, this is a nicer theory. He liked the Einstein-Rosen bridge solution better than the Schwarzschild solution. And he said, well, maybe we should just do this, and then that fixes the problem. So sure, I think there are ways to think about this in the space-time picture. I don't know if every modification you can do in space-time would correspond to some shape dynamic solution.
I don't know if it has to, but anyway. Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
Maybe I would move this to a discussion for the panel session because, I would like to intervene here too, but later. There were Lee and Carlo, I think. Okay.
Yeah.
a general comment. There seemed to be a recurring idea that quantum mechanics works much better if there is a preferred slicing. I've heard this over and over and over again. It seemed to be a bit strange to hear this idea after over half a century of quantum field theory, which is a fantastically quantum mechanics, the best theory we have about the world besides general relativity. It's certainly quantum mechanical, and it doesn't have a preferred slicing. Take any formulation you want about quantum field theory. You don't need to go to infinity. You can have Weidman functions. You can have Schwinger functions. They are nicely located. There's this causal in all the sense that physically make any sense. There's no preferred slicing, perfectly compatible with quantum mechanics. Why anybody has this idea that quantum mechanics works better with a preferred slicing?
So I didn't say that quantum mechanics necessarily works better in a preferred slicing. What I tried to say was that the problem of finding a quantum representation of the space-time diffeomorphisms is a very difficult one. We know that. And if you have a preferred slicing, you don't have to solve that problem. So that's what I said. But I agree with you. That I think that there's some mythology about, in some sense, there is some mythology that people say, quantum time is incompatible with time and relativity, but I never really properly understood those statements.
Right. This is a small comment. This is a comment on my heart. It's not a finger. bringing back a preferred slicing, and sorry, Giorgio, for that, it sounds enormously like Tycho Brahe to me. I mean, it's just Copernicus works, but come on. I mean, the Earth should have a preferred. So let's keep the Earth. Everything goes around the sun, but the sun goes around the Earth. Is that if we learn that something is not there in the universe, I don't think we have to go through complicated story about general covariance. It's not there in the universe, as George was saying strongly. Simultaneity is not something that has to do with existing preferred slicing in the universe very well. So why keeping bringing it back over and over again?
I would say that on its own, the argument I presented is not terribly strong. That it's a really hard problem. Why don't we just try to do it a different way? And that will tell us something fundamental. So I agree with you that that's on its own not a particularly strong argument. So what I think makes the argument stronger could be if you introduce something like the arguments Lee was presenting yesterday about trying to understand becoming and or maybe actually I shouldn't say them myself because I think Lee could do a better and you guys want to respond, but let me just respond. So there might, but also I would say that my what I didn't probably do complete justice to was that in shape dynamics at least, you might have some motivation for considering this Sitter symmetry principle that you're using to fix the foliation. So that is another argument that selects this preferred choice of coordinates. It's not like it's a randomly chosen symmetry that we just thought of. Enrique has some arguments that if you wanted to fix a foliation with a symmetry, that you're pretty limited with the kinds of ways you can do it. But also there's just, other arguments that maybe you might want to talk about scaling variant quantities in physics.
Well, yes, when Carlo was saying we have quantum field theory in curved space-time, and it's a perfectly relativistic formulation, you don't need a preferred foliation to formulate that. And that is true, but it works because you have a fixed causal structure for quantum field theory in curved space-time, the formulation that you say, or for the standard model in flat space-time, the formulation that is the best theory that we have at hand next to general relativity. But the problems with that, and you know it, is when this formalism doesn't work when you have an indefinite causal structure, when the dynamics determines the causal structure. So there are many possibilities. You have your proposal that you put on the blackboard yesterday, but definitely one logical possibility is to invent a dynamical system in which the causal structure is, in which you have an evolution parameter that has a priori nothing to do with time, nothing to do with any specific experience, but where you have, similar to what you were proposing, in solutions an emergent causal structure, and in that background, and only in that limit, you recover general covariance, and that's a possible solution to this problem, and it requires a lot of detail to work out. It requires to work out that there are a large number of solutions that have this property, that have the property that they look from the inside, like divergent general relativity. And that's the philosophy. And I think Sean would completely agree with what I was saying.
Probably.
The point is not whether there's relativistic quantum field theory in the sense of the Lorentz group or the Poincaré group. The difficulty that is alluded to is getting many finger time represented in a quantum theory, which requires, and this point has come up before, so let me emphasize it. It's what Bianca was trying to say yesterday. If you want to quantize general relativity canonically, you need not just a set of solutions to the Hamiltonian constraint, but you need a set of observables, each of which commutes with all of the infinite number of Hamiltonian constraints. And then you need an inner product. Carl, you know this very well. You need an inner product on the space of solutions which makes those operators Hermitian. And that's the special difficulty, which is eliminated if you can quantize in a fixed slicing. The other answer to why would you want to give up on the gauge symmetry of many finger time when it's so elegantly achieved in the classical level, one can just say the same thing back. And this is just for fun. After all, whether shape dynamics is useful or true or not depends on the results. And we're just going blah, blah, blah about what we hope and expect. I really hope that these guys, I think we should challenge these guys to say, after all, it's been some years, what's really been achieved with this point of view? And I hope that you can address that. But what they achieve, they don't just fix the gauge and eliminate the many finger time gauge invariants. They trade that gauge symmetry for the gauge symmetry of local three-dimensional vial transformations. And you could say the same thing back. You could say, here's a beautiful gauge symmetry of nature, local scale transformations on the three-dimensional space. Why would you give that up? That's such a beautiful gauge symmetry principle. Do you really want to give that up just in order to get many finger time? But I hope, I want to put out a challenge for all the shape dynamic people in the room. There's a lot of blah, blah, blah for and against, but I think it's time for you guys to put a list on the blackboard of what's been achieved with this direction.
Now?
Before the end of this session.
There is a quick one finger question by Vikar and then George.
I have a couple of comments on a preferred time gauge fixing, which is what we're discussing. So Carlo made the point and then Tim attempted to respond saying that preferred slicing is not necessarily inconsistent with the emergence of Lorentz invariance at a lower scale. So the comment is that there's a particular matter time slicing which actually recovers Lorentz invariance and quantum fields on fixed background. And I can tell you about that.
Thank you.
In the spirit of provocation, I've already made a comment about space-like surfaces. I'm going to make an even stronger statement, which is that physics actually happens along time-like world lines in the real universe. and there are many ways that you can see this. Now, I'm a relativist. I love drawing past light cones, but actually, they're basically irrelevant to what is happening in this room in the universe. Ask yourself, everything in this room, where does it come from? How big a bit of the universe do you need to know what happens here? And the answer is a co-moving sphere of about 1 megaparsec. All the rest of the universe is basically irrelevant. And that's because the time-like world lines are characteristics. But before decoupling, it's true that you need stuff going up to the speed of sound, which is not the speed of light. It's this. After decoupling, basically things are happening along these time-like world lines. And this is why we have to spend such huge sums of money in order to detect the gravitational perturbations. It's because they are basically make very little difference. Even the cosmic microwave background, we have to spend a lot of money actually measuring the cosmic microwave background. Because, and so in fact, the statement that I would make is that in the real universe as it really is, the real influences are time-like world lines, like the helium in this room came way back past from time-like world lines, and the null world lines and the light cones, which the light cones which I love to draw, are really irrelevant to most of the real physics that happens in cosmology. And for instance, in the Friedmann equation, you've got ordinary differential equations, not hyperbolic equations, ordinary differential equations, which is an expression of how that works.
So,
thank you.
Maybe I can add to that comment because it's something I've been thinking about throughout various discussions. If you wanted to test whether the maximal extension of Schwarzschild is the correct solution, how would you do it? Right. So it's yeah. Most people believe that it should be, but anyway.
So, bring up Schwarzschild. how do you feel the ideas of complementarity that some black hole people have used discussing black holes fit into this general picture?
How do I feel about it?
Yeah.
You mean like Toph's? No.
That you have a sort of a completely different quantum mechanics depending on where the outside, exterior of black hole and interior of black hole.
In general or in relation to shape dynamics? I mean.
Well, is this an example of something? I should say it's something I find very objectionable.
I don't know.
Shape dynamics itself, it's kind of a moot point because. There is an objectivist point of view. You have a configuration space and you work there. So, but this is the kind of issues that arise when one thinks about quantum mechanics and slicings this property of general relativity. I think there was a comment or?
It was a question about clarification of this comment.
I think it's been superseded. Okay, so we have Rafael.
A small footnote to your talk. I don't think it's not strictly right to say that you can't handle non-abelian gauge theories without gauge fixing, if you're willing to use a computer, right? I think people who are doing lattice gauge theories, someone may correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they actually don't do a gauge fixing because it would just make life more difficult. But that does rely on the fact that the gauge group is compact, so you can actually integrate over the whole gauge group at each point. Diffeomorphism is a different thing, but I just wanted to make a small footnote to that claim. It needs to be qualified
I made lots of claims which could have used more qualification. And in that sense, what I meant by some form of gauge fixing is also, I mean, you have to construct some kind of gauge invariant observable, right? That's the alternative. And that's what you mean. I mean, you still have to construct some form of gauge invariant observable.
Yeah. Sure, but that's not the same as gauge fixing.
That's true.
Gauge fixing might be a route to discuss constructing a gauge invariant observable, but.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you made the point, but in lattice gauge theory, people What they do is they take a Hamiltonian that doesn't look much like what the Yang-Mills Hamiltonian one would get from the Gendre transform of the Lagrangian looks like. It's just something that's the sum over Wilson loop operators. And these are gauge invariant already. So if you could write down a Hamiltonian purely in terms of gauge invariant operators, then you're right. You can give it to a computer and it'll. Sure. I'm sorry. You can, well, you can in principle do it if you wanted to use a Hamiltonian in terms of one that has. But in principle, if you could write down the Hamiltonian or a Lagrangian, let's just say the action, in terms of the sum of gauge invariant operators, then it would be very easy to give it to a computer. But the point Sean's trying to make is the other option, which one mostly would learn in graduate school, is if you want to go deal with the Lagrangian that one usually has, then there's a gauge fixing involved.
I don't disagree.
All right, so further questions? Yes. Lisa.
So, okay, let me make the statement this. You have to find a way of projecting onto the reduced phase space and engage fixing.
Well, they do sure group averaging, so, but.
It's the same. Anyway, sorry.
I just wanted to clarify a bit to what Vasudev was saying, because of course we're doing that. It's something that's very much happening in quantum gravity, attempts to, you need to discretize the geometry first. There's different ideas how you should discretize it. I mean, we've heard about causal sets. I don't know if Renata will mention causal dynamical triangulations in different approaches. And then after discretization, you can write a covariant action, more or less covariant, depending on what you're doing, and you can do it on the computer. And so all of this is happening. So I don't.
I'm not saying it won't happen.
No,
I'm just
saying
what the options are.
You sounded overly pessimistic about it, so I wanted to clarify.
Okay, if I don't. Are you wanting to? Nobody else's.
How much time do we have?
I don't want to be overcritical, but I hear. Raphael says, I think one could do quantum gravity in this way, and he has a model for quantum gravity. It might be complete, incomplete, missing pieces, but that's a quantum gravity theory. I mean, there's loop quantum gravity, and that's a quantum gravity theory. There's string theory, this is a quantum gravity theory. And then there is shape dynamics, which is, well, all these quantum gravity motivations, but it's all classical. There's no quantum gravity theory. So it's, I sorry?
That's not entirely true.
So what is it? What can you do? What can one do in quantum gravity with that? That's the question, I think. So why don't you talk about that instead of the motivations, the
So of course when you talk about okay. So when you talk about quantum gravity, there are serious problems with constructing wave functions of continuous conformal geometries without any extra symmetries where you have mini superspaces. In mini superspaces, we can exactly tell you what we are doing, and we can describe a dynamical system similar to the one that I presented, the Bohmian mechanical system that I presented in my talk on Tuesday. Or was it Monday or Tuesday? Well, I think it was Monday, actually. And that goes to the last point here. Notwithstanding that there are technical problems, and I would challenge that nobody has an honest answer I know Carlo will object to that, but how a large scale, well coarse grained geometric picture arises in any form of quantum gravity, and this what it boils down to in shape dynamics is finding a systematic way, something like cylindrical functions of spatial conformal geometries. This is the problem, and constructing a Hilbert space. For many superspaces where we can solve this model, where we can solve this technical problem from the onset, we are in this situation here. And we can give you a specific dynamical system that has that is neither about space-time, neither about space-time geometry, nor about unitary quantum evolution, that just gives you a curve in shape space. But from that curve, you can deduce quantum phenomena. It has intrinsic quantum phenomena encoded in it. And it has a classical limit, and because it's a Bohmian curve, it just tells you what, without any approximation, it tells you what the classical limit is, because it's when the curve follows basically a classical evolution equation. That looks like a space-time that is a solution to Einstein's equation. So this is the last point that I wrote here. There are three other points. The first point was essentially the point that Lee made, which is...
The first
point is essentially the point that Lee made. And
I think this is very relevant for issues of quantum gravity as well. Because, I mean, if you have a general theory or general action or Hamiltonian, and you can identify what the observables are, I can try to apply standard methods of quantization, like path integral, or transition amplitudes between observables, or try to find out approximations of a Hamiltonian operator evolution. Then you can still argue that the problems that we have are technical in the same way that problems for other approaches are technical. But yeah, sorry.
The challenge that loop quantum gravity also has a problem that it doesn't, that in coarse grinning sense, as of now, it does not produce a continuum space time geometry.
Yeah, there's other approaches.
CDTs are different. I accept that they find a universality class of foliated 3 plus 1 dimensional geometries, and they actually have a geometric phase. This is what we are missing. This is related to the problem that I was saying about finding wave functions of conformal geometry, finding a sector in loop quantum gravity that coarse grains set of solutions to the Hamiltonian constraint in loop quantum gravity, or spin foams that coarse grain to genuine solutions of Einstein's equation at the coarse grain level.
Can I?
We have a couple of comments here. Just a quick comment of mine that if your problem is doing quantum gravity, your problem then would be to find the classical limit and not so the continuous is just an approximation of some discrete theory. Let me finish. And so we know how to recover the classical limit. Then we can discuss about the continuous, but I think also Daniel has a comment on this.
I think I agree with basically everything you said. Only one comment that I also like the results in dynamical triangulations. When you say that they have at least partially solved the problem of the continuum and the coarse graining, they've done it using concerning one very simple type of observables, which is the volume. And if you're fine with that, then we have some partial results also in spin foams and loop quantum gravity in looking just at very coarse grained observables like the total volume.
I would say,
I mean, this is just really an extra comment. It's not.
I agree with that. In this sense, I would say CDT is in one step further, and these are the 2 plus 1 dimensional torus universes that when you interpret them as solutions of shape dynamics, they produce exactly the curve in shape space that you expect from the classical limit, and I think that is a real achievement of CDT that is not matched by any other microscopic approach, where you take micro degrees of freedom, coarse grain, and to look at them in
to just get the answer.
You mean
in
2 plus 1?
In
2 plus 1.
You can do it exactly.
Maybe it's
no,
not.
Wait. Listen, you guys. We
shouldn't debate.
The point is not to have a cat fight among the six different approaches to quantum gravity.
Exactly.
And you can't do that. I can do this. I asked one specific question. Tim, please. We had a talk about shape dynamics. It's your opportunity to educate us all about shape dynamics. Let's not get into, you can't do that, you can't do that, I can do this, no, you can do this. I just asked for a list of the achievements of the program Shape Dynamics so we can evaluate it. It's not useful to talk about what other approaches can or cannot do.
Thank you.
So let me say something.
I think we should move this to the panel discussion because also Chopin has been excluded by this discussion so far, and so it should be be included again. And where is he, by the way?
Wait, shall we thank Sean again?
And
what?
Let's thank Sean. Thank you. And yes, please. Okay, so if you guys want, we can start with this request by Lee of having a list of achievements that Tim apparently wrote on the blackboard. But I don't know if you want to start.
I didn't get a chance to respond to Carlo's comment. I think it's a good comment. I think also Lee's challenge to write what we've done on the board is a good thing. I don't want to say too much, just to say that quantum gravity is hard, but also general relativity is hard. And we have a new way, we have a suggestion for a new ontology for how to think about classical general relativity. And that suggestion is within the paradigm of conformal geometry. We don't have a ton of mathematical methods that are designed to deal with conformal geometries, like we had in special relativity and we have differential geometry. So we don't even know if we're working with the right variables. We don't know what the right techniques to use. It's not that we haven't tried, but we've tried to borrow techniques from different fields which were adapted to the space-time picture. And what we've been finding is that they don't work terribly well. So you're right, if we don't find a way out soon, maybe that's a bad sign. But
if I may come in, my personal perspective on this whole question.
This,
yes. Yes. It's all classical. Right. Yeah, but these are two different questions. You asked for a list of results, and Carlo asked where is quantum gravity. My answer to your question is I have to understand the classical theory better before moving on, and I'm finding a lot of interesting things there. So I've been stuck there for a long time, and this is Tim's list is a list of things. Well, his personal perspective is mostly stuff that recent stuff that we have been doing with him, Julian, and David Sloan as well. And all of this is classical, except possibly these mini superspace models that he wants to study. He has his personal perspective on using BOM as a solution of the many world problem. We might or might not agree with that, but that is certainly a small first step in the direction of the quantum theory. At the classical level, we have a bunch of stuff. This has been discussed. Observables are straightforward there. So constructing them constructively is a different matter, but at least conceptually they're very simple. We had this result in 2014 about that Tim mentioned, about the observation that shape degrees of freedom really point in one direction in time, and each solution splits in two. This is something that is going to come out next week. At the classical level, we have a continuation through the Big Bang, and Tim mentioned it in his talk. It's purely classical, so we live in conformal superspace. We can continue each curve through the Big Bang. If there is a scalar field, massless scalar field, if there is what is called quiescence. So 1 degree of freedom among the matter degrees of freedom that survives the strong curvature regime that takes place near the Big Bang. If that is there, we can continue through. Otherwise, the curving shape space keeps going on forever. So this is our latest result. And I don't know what this team should illuminate us about this last point. Have you, please?
But we also have results on black holes.
Yes.
Did you want to talk
about that? OK, before, where black holes are very non-trivial. They don't cover the whole Schwarzschild, Kruskal extension of Schwarzschild space-time. And we're studying gravitational collapse, and it's very challenging and interesting. We don't have definite results on physical observables because they're the trickiest part, but we're studying them. And, well, cosmological solutions, of course, again, is what is relevant here. They're not just FRW. FRW is a point in shape space, and it's a completely trivial solution. So we really want to study anisotropies, and that's where the result on the continuation through the Big Bang came out. And
new paper?
Sorry?
Your new paper?
And here there's Daniel, with whom we've been studying solutions with matter. So not insisting on a spherical symmetry, which kills all the shape degrees of freedom, forces us to introduce some matter degrees of freedom. And we find whole classes of solutions that, again, they don't cover a whole maximally extended space-time. So there's interesting stuff there that we need to explore. And it's all at the classical level. This is my perspective, so I don't want to cover what other people have been doing. Maybe Tim has something to add about the last point.
No.
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 Yeah, I can ask a question to Chopin.
The, it's, yeah.
Yes, now so, we're paddling. Yes. So we have until 4 to discuss.
Can I ask a question to Chopin?
Sure.
That's
so, just to change the topic a little bit, Chopin, about what I don't. So your time is defined by the scale factor, by that g.
Yes.
And that's a constant for each time slice. That's what defines each time slice, is that being a constant.
The time is the logarithmic volume. It's the integral of. It's not the time. Is not. It's not. It's a global time. It's not a multi-finger. And the Hamiltonian, you have a Hamiltonian, not a Hamiltonian density.
Mm-hmm. So okay. So my. So. Just my okay. So my point was that the diffeomorphisms will change the determinant of G at each point. A general diffeomorphisms.
Yes.
But you're saying that since you have the logarithm.
And it's the volume, so it doesn't change the volume for compact. Manifold. It changed the determinant at each point, but it doesn't change the volume.
Sure.
Okay, well, maybe I will reiterate my question because I'm still confused about it. The role of the Hamiltonian constraint is also to reduce by one further degree of freedom per point, and you don't have that in this.
You don't have a Hamiltonian constraint.
What about that degree of freedom? What is going on?
We don't have a Hamiltonian constraint. Neither do we have pi, which is trace of the momentum.
Trace of the momentum is zero.
It's missing.
Missing or zero?
It's missing. Because the Hamiltonian is made up of traceless part of the momentum, the unimodular metric, and the determinant of the metric. There's no trace k in that, and there's no pi.
Yeah.
Okay, but the unimodular metric again.
Unimodular metric.
Right.
There's 5 degrees.
Yes, but don't you need the incompressible diffeomorphism to transform?
We also
that,
have the diffeomorphism constraint.
Right.
Yes.
We should look into the details of that. So if there are other questions about this particular topic, otherwise, I see a raised hand there, but no. Basso, OK. If you want to switch topic, I have a question for everyone, maybe. You mentioned GRIB of horizons. Maybe you didn't want to refer to what is normally understood as a GRIB of problem in QFT, because you are very interested in patches of space-time, right? Or extendibility of coordinate systems. But what about the GRIB of problem of Young-Mills in quantum gravity? Recent research indicates that having a maximal possible size in a particular gauge fixing of your gauge fixing in phase space introduces a scale, which people want to relate to lambda QCD. Could there be something like that going on in quantum gravity? I want to throw this on the table for everyone to say something. Yeah. Is there a GRIB of horizon in quantum gravity related to having to gauge fixed diffeomorphism, diffeomorphism symmetry, and not being able to extend that everywhere in phase space? If that is so, this typically introduces a scale, which is the radius of this thing in, because it's a dimensionful quantity. And what is it? What is the lambda QCD of quantum gravity? Anyone wants to say something?
Yes.
I'm not entirely sure I understood what the problem is supposed to be, but if the problem has to do with configuration space as the space of three metrics, that's a contractible space. So I don't think you'll get the kind of topological Grieboff problem that comes about in the non-abelian gauge theories.
There's the Grieboff problem, and then there's the existence of Grieboff horizons due to particular gauge fixing, right?
That was not me. Yeah. And you're right, configuration spaces, these are topological vector spaces, so they're contractible, but these problems come from the topology of the orbit itself. The Grieboff problem comes from, and there you do have, you can have problems, in fact, even for gravity, because of the topology of the diffeomorphism group. And the quotient, yeah. Fisher discussed this as well. You know, Arthur Fisher, he has this paper. Well, anyways, we can chat about it later. I don't know what it means to have a Grieboff problem for this, but I'm just saying it's not ruled out.
Right, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the diffeomorphism group is very poorly understood group.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of pathologies. Even the exponential map is not locally onto, and so
it's injective, yeah. You mean the infinite dimensional one? Yeah, it's injective, but not onto, yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, Lee, I was ignoring you.
The matter organizers are going to quote this discussion. We've had such an energetic, chaotic, engrossing 4 days. And this discussion is getting in the direction of technical squabbles, technical issues among experts in the narrow range. And so I hope nobody's offended. We're going to have the discussion. We'll take Carlos Kallet, go to the coffee break early, and come back and hear the summary of the whole meeting.
Here, yeah.
Sure.
Nope.
So I have a question, just in case you have a clear answer. This is something I believe you have talked in detail. I don't want to open a... I want to know what is the point of view of you guys who think about scale invariance with respect to the fact that in quantum gravity, let me put it this way, if there's a theory that a priori seems to have a scale, is quantum gravity, because h bar g is a length square. So there is a scale. There seems to be a fundamental scale in length theory, in string theory, which is a string scale. So a fundamental scale in LQG. There is a fundamental scale in other approaches. How do you view this? If you want to give an answer, otherwise we can discuss this later.
H bar should be defined relationally here, so referring to something that is in the universe. If you work on conformal superspace, things are dimensionless. Nevertheless, quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, it will introduce a notion of extendedness on your configuration space. There will be a wave function which has wave modes. It's not a curve on configuration space. And we see that very clearly in toy models, in particle models or mini superspace models. So depending on how extended on configuration space, on shape space, your wave function will be, you will have this notion, relational notion of uncertainty, of quantum uncertainty. So H bar surely looks, in this case, if the fundamental theory is a wave function on conformal superspace, H bar looks dimensionful just because it's the product of a dimensionless notion of extendedness of your wave function on your configuration space times some scale that is in the universe, namely what you use to measure your to compare your distances with, so the size of the distance between two galaxies, something in the universe. So you can write models which in some semi-classical limit should look like they're giving you a Schrödinger equation, which is dimensionful and everything. But they don't refer to any dimensionful fundamental constant. So this is my take on it. We've been thinking about this issue for a while. I don't know if you want to answer.
Okay. Any last quick comments on this? So the point of the session was to talk about whether there is a preferred slicing in nature. We had two provocative proposals. I hope that they at least established that it's possible to imagine formulating classical and quantum gravity where there is a preferred slicing. Let's break here, which is 15 minutes early. So we'll come back at 4:15 and we'll have three summaries from very different points of view of the meeting, what was achieved, what was learned. Come back ready to contribute your own point of view. We'll have last discussions, and then we'll thank everybody and go home.
Shall we thank everyone?
Okay.